You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of June 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Clemency Burton-Hill and Hugo MacDonald.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Ben, what have you got for us?
We're going to be looking at how Russia's going to respond to American plans to arm the Syrian rebels, and we're also going to be investigating what the foreign policy fallout of protests in Turkey will mean with a German threat to freeze EU-Turkey negotiations.
Looking forward to that. Talking about Turkey, we have an exclusive interview with the CEO of the airline that just keeps on climbing. In these turbulent times for the aviation industry, we ask, just what is Turkish Airlines' secret?
Asia growing, Africa growing. So we used to have the North America and Europe, but right now Africa is growing very fast. Growth rate is about 10%. In Turkey, it's about 20%. Huh?
And the Monocle menu team heads to the World Street Food Congress in Singapore to sample some of the treats on offer.
We ask to the client what level of a spice you want. We have three levels, low, medium, and high. Some people ask, yeah, I have very spicy, not level three, level five, please. Okay, level five.
All that, plus we play some delicious music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the latest headlines with David Spencer.
Thank you, Monocle 24 News. I'm David Spencer. Russia says US claims of chemical weapon use by President Assad's forces in Syria are fabricated. The findings have led President Barack Obama to authorize the sending of weapons to Syrian rebels for the first time. Assad's forces and their Lebanese Hezbollah allies have been making gains in the north of the country, putting opposition forces under pressure. Ben Rhodes is Obama's deputy national security advisor and stood by the claims in a conference call with the media.
Use of chemical weapons violates international norms and crosses red lines that have existed in the international community for decades. I'd also note that we believe that the Assad regime maintains control of chemical weapons within Syria, and we have not seen any reliable reporting or corroborated reporting indicating that the opposition has acquired or used chemical weapons.
The polls have opened in the Iran presidential election, in which a successor to Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who can't run for a third term in office, will be chosen. Six candidates are competing, although none is a serious reformist who can pose a threat to Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the election in Iran will change nothing.
This regime will continue to be led by one man, one ruler, who will continue Iran's quest for nuclear weapons.
Turkish protesters have held talks with the Prime Minister in a bid to resolve a dispute that's led to 2 weeks of violence. Recep Tayyip Erdogan met a delegation overnight, including members of the umbrella protest group Taksim Solidarity, which is opposed to the redevelopment of a park in Istanbul. Protests in Brazil against a rise in bus and underground fares have spread from Sao Paulo to other cities, including Rio de Janeiro. Marches have taken place calling for the increase to be revoked, but in the country's largest city, police had to use tear gas to calm the demonstrations. 40 people were arrested in Sao Paulo and dozens have been injured. The British government has issued an alert to airlines around the world, urging them not to allow former US intelligence contractor Edward Snowden to board flights to the United Kingdom. It's understood the alert is dated Monday and says carriers should deny Snowden boarding because the individual is highly likely to be refused entry to the UK. He's known to be in Hong Kong, where he conducted an interview earlier this week explaining why he revealed details of the US spying program called PRISM. An Australian radio host has been suspended from a Perth broadcaster after asking Prime Minister Julia Gillard if her partner, Tim Matheson, is gay. Howard Sattler from 6PR caused a storm by pressing Gillard about what were called myths, rumours, snide jokes and innuendos. It's understood 6PR management have apologised and said the questions posed by Sattler were disrespectful and irrelevant. The incident led to a heated debate between the two.
You can confirm that he's not.
Oh, Howard, don't be ridiculous. Of course not.
In a heterosexual relationship, that's all I'm asking.
Well, Howard, you and I have just talked about that, so now that is bordering. Let me just bring you back to Earth.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much for that, David Spencer. It's 5 minutes past eight here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London,
Londres, Holland,
London, London,
Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London,
London.
This is Monocle 24.
We are live from Studio One here in London. This is Midori House. The time is 15:06 in Hong Kong, 10:06 in Istanbul and 8:06 here in London.
And we start the show with our daily agenda setter. Three stories you need to know for the next 24 hours. And setting the agenda for us today is Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Welcome, Ben.
Thank you.
And what have you got for us today?
What? The main story of the past 24 hours has been the American admission after kind of several weeks of kind of intense negotiation within the corridors of power that Syria has in fact used chemical weapons and that the Americans will be providing direct sort of lethal aid to the Syrian rebels. The big question, I think, today is how will Russia react? And we've already seen the Russian parliament announce that the evidence is fabricated, with Russia moving to a formal denial of the use of chemical weapons by Assad's forces. So general ramping up of tensions to a higher level in what is turning into one of the most significant proxy wars of the past few decades between Moscow and Washington.
It's interesting that you use the phrase ramping up, because that's the comment that the White House have given on the authorization. They haven't given an official comment. Do we have any sense of what this kind of military support is going to be like?
The American support, not exactly. The big question for me is like, how far will Russia go to match it? And what we've seen in the past few months is that with aid that's been coming to the Syrian rebels via Qatar or via Saudi Arabia, Russia's been trying to match it and surpass it by a significant amount. And I think that this will only lead to yet more arms coming from Moscow to kind of arm Assad, and a kind of general entrenching of the divisions already settling into Syria.
So it's a topic that is obviously going to be dominating press today. What's number two?
Well, number two is, what are the foreign policy fallouts of the ongoing protests in Istanbul against the rule of the Turkish leader Recep Tayyip Erdogan? And we're seeing the first fallout, which is that this may lead to a freeze in Turkish-EU negotiations. And the long-held Turkish dream of joining the European Union had been sort of petering out a few years ago, because the EU and Turkey hadn't been opening any more chapters in the negotiation process. And now Germany wants to block, according to sort of several sources reported in the Financial Times, the opening of a new negotiation chapter for regional policy. And it's citing that this is not a time to reward Erdogan.
Turkey's, though, has the membership prospects have always been clouded by German opposition. Is this just another step in that?
Well, what we're seeing is lots of long-standing opponents of Turkish membership of the EU, which include Angela Merkel's party, which is the ruling party in Germany, the CDU, using these protests as a chance to close down those prospects of eventual Turkish membership to the EU. And we're seeing like a lot of opposition to this, in which the Swedish foreign minister, just as I was coming in, issued a tweet saying that he thought that despite police brutality in Turkey, the membership chapter should be unlocked and the process should be ongoing. So it's a very tense debate right now about how should the EU respond to Erdogan's police brutality. Is it a moment to kind of hug Turkey closer, because there is signs of a kind of Occupy-style, very European-looking civil society in Istanbul? Or is this a moment not to reward him as if he was any other sort of leader in Europe's eastern neighbourhood?
Erdogan yesterday with some fighting talk saying that he wouldn't be bullied by the rest of the world. Do you think this is going to ramp up itself over the course of today?
Very, very contradictory over the past few days. We've seen Erdogan meet protest leaders, then issue fighting talk claiming this was his final warning. We've seen attempts to kind of calm down the atmosphere in Taksim Square, including a piano performance through the night to sort of soothe tensions. We've seen just in the past few hours news that government may refer the case to a court, refer the case to a court, and redevelopment there will be subject to those legal groundings. So it's very uncertain, because at the same time we have Erdogan threatening to clamp down on what he views as a public sanitary issue, claiming that the park smells of piss.
I think we can say that word on air at this time in the morning. Just before we very quickly move on to another story, just if the negotiations are frozen, what likelihood is there that they'll be restarted again in terms of Turkey's membership to the EU?
Well, they probably won't be restarted under the leadership of Mr. Erdogan. And what we've seen is that Erdogan has reacted to, for example, a few days ago, there was a motion in the EU Parliament condemning police brutality with extremely paranoid and aggressive talk. And this morning, the Turkish Foreign Ministry issued a kind of statement condemning attacks on Turkey on a mysterious global interest lobby. It's very unclear who those people are supposed to be, but it's supposed to involve international bankers and the international media.
Ben, let's move on to your final topic then.
Well, final topic I think is actually quite significant for global geopolitics, which is a long-standing plan by a Chinese-owned company to build a new canal cutting through Nicaragua as an alternative to the Panama Canal. The government of Nicaragua has finally approved this. And I think this is potentially very significant, in which we are seeing a Chinese alternative to the American-controlled Panama Canal opening up between the Atlantic and the Pacific. And this, of course, is a long-standing Chinese foreign policy objective to control key waterways where, as they would say, the Americans can't choke them with the use of their navy.
Presumably, hydroengineering techniques have advanced somewhat since the Panama Canal was completed in 1914, nearly 100 years ago. But what sort of logistical challenges are there for the Chinese in constructing this canal?
Well, it's a $40 billion challenge. That's what I can say this morning. So we can safely assume that that will run significantly over budget. According to kind of the history of the kind of canal building in this part of the world, Nicaragua was an easier place to build a canal because the center of the country is a large lake, but it was political issues that meant that the Americans chose originally kind of a century back to build the canal in Panama.
And what are the Americans saying in response to this? I mean, presumably not.
Silence. Yeah. Silence. They're concentrating on Syria. But in general, I think this will contribute to a strange evolution in the American right, in which you're increasingly seeing China eclipse Russia as sort of Her Majesty's opposition in global politics.
Indeed. Well, Ben Judah, author of Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Many thanks indeed for coming on the show.
Coming up, Monocle sits down with Turkish Airlines CEO to discover the secret to their astonishing success.
Whether you're in the midst of a busy business day in Europe or eating your cereal on the East Coast, The Briefing sets you up with a fast-paced mix of news and views that you won't find anywhere else.
It's a very beautiful phone, I think. It's not out till next month. That's the only phone outside of HTC at this moment.
This one I'm holding?
Yes.
No wonder we've got security.
We'll bring you the latest developments in aviation, technology, defense, retail, and media with our industry experts, a rundown of the US and Latin American papers, plus a sharp business review of the day.
It really came about with us saying, you know, this would make sense to do something that we would enjoy shopping at and kind of change the retail landscape a little bit.
So tune in to The Briefing every day at midday London time, 7 a.m. in New York.
When it comes to retail, the Taiwanese capital's independent shops are increasingly worthy of attention. Monocle's filmmaker wandered down side streets to discover a myriad of new small shops, each with a concept totally their own.
The name for the Pinmo Pure Store came to founder Richard Wong in a dream. It too is a hybrid, a tiny space on a residential street in the Daan district that carries paper goods and clothing. A design agency shares the space, and tea and cookies are available even though there's no space to sit down.
Changing the city's retail landscape, one little shop at a time. Taipei Retail, in the Films menu on Monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House, here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald, and Clemency Burton-Hill. The Airports Council International Annual Congress and Exhibition concluded this week, taking place in Istanbul, a suggestion that Turkey's advance continues despite the ongoing protests at Prime Minister Erdogan's rule. Playing host to over 800 senior execs from airports and aviation, the Congress addresses the issues affecting the industry, from supply, technology, new markets and more.
Well, Monocle's transport editor Tristan McAllister is here with us in the studio in London. Good morning, Tristan. Earlier this week, you were braving tear gas and protests, I hear, to be at that ACI conference, and you met with Turkish Airlines CEO Dr. Temel Kotil. Presumably you were talking about his company's extraordinary growth. I know that last year they had a threefold increase in operating profit, which seems to be completely defying the odds as other airlines around the aviation industry are forced to cut back. So what on earth is their secret?
Well, of course, Clemency, we talked about that. And I think a lot of people in the industry are asking what their secret is, because this airline, of course, has really taken off, so to speak. Pun completely intended.
No, it was a real story for puns.
Right. In the last few years. So, I did speak to him about it, and he gave a really interesting prediction for what's to come in the next 100 years.
So the world is harmonizing, you know, Asia growing, Africa growing. So we used to have the North America and Europe. That's the basic trade and airline business, everything. But right now, Africa is growing very fast. Growth rate is about 10%. In Turkey, it's about 20%. Huh? And the Middle East growing about 10%. You know, Asia growing about 10%. Average is about 5% worldwide. So coming back, that shift making Istanbul very crucial places. Istanbul was the center of the business in the Byzantine time. Istanbul was on the Ottoman time, but coming back again by nature, not because of Turkey, but because the world is growing. Coming to the Africa, I visited several places myself. I was flying so many places there. I believe features of Africa. In 100 years, Africa will be more important than any other continent, believe me.
Interesting, Tristan, there. Africa growing by 20% for Turkish Airlines. Is that something to do with the geography of where Istanbul is in relation to being sort of quite a good sort of hub to get down to Africa?
Well, you know, Hugo, what's key for these guys is that the new airplane technology, smaller planes can get farther, especially planes like the 737, the A320. So less people can go farther. They're three and a half hours closer than Europe in a lot of cases to the Middle East, Asia and Africa. And they've launched service to some places in Africa where most airlines wouldn't even tread. In particular, they launched service 2 years ago to Mogadishu. Turkish actually went and helped make the airport secure. They worked with government officials. And Kotal says it's been more than just a financial payoff for them and the city.
In the first flight, there was a family from Canada, and the elder woman and five children, you know. And of course, in the first flight, I was there and I'm talking with the passenger. She told me, I am visiting my home after 18 years. It's amazing. It's visiting because of we are high brand and we give the confidence that we're flying is secure and safe.
So obviously, Hugo and Clemency, these routes really need to make sense for the airline financially, but it seems here, too, that they see one of their big mandates as being a connector. And, of course, this is a marketing touch point. They talk about this, but it's very clear that they seem to be changing these markets in which they're going into. And that confidence, the confidence from a brand like Turkish means that it instills confidence in others to go there. And that's a lot of power.
Mm, and significant risk that they took to fly that route in particular, and it seems to be paying off. Now, we can't mention Turkey, of course, Tristan, without asking about the protests at Taksim Square and elsewhere. I know that you personally were affected by what was going on right next door to the conference.
Yeah, we one morning of course, I wasn't staying right nearby, so I'd take a taxi about 10 minutes. And we'd arrived there. I thought I was having a bit of an allergy attack, but it turns out it wasn't. The air was thick, and I started to get, my eyes started to water, and my nose started to
explode.
Seize up. I mean, it was a little much. And then my throat, of course, and I kept thinking, well, gosh, I didn't take my allergy medicine that morning, so maybe it was just that. But I walk into the conference, and of course, people start saying, did you smell the tear gas outside? I was like, oh my gosh, was that it? So I mean, in some ways, I was living the story. But you know, other than that, it wasn't too much of a burden on the conference. I think a lot of people were worried about it. But if you talk to airport officials, they tell you they are used to things going wrong. So, you know, everyone showed up for the conference it was supposed to. They've dealt with hurricanes, they've dealt with volcanoes, they've dealt with riots, they've dealt with floods. So, I mean, this is a very resilient bunch of people. But I was also able to ask Dr. Kotal about the effect on the airline and whether or not they had contingencies in place. And this is what he said.
What's happening here is, of course, complicated. There is no time and go to report it. But what I believe is that the youngs, just we cross them right now, is they are a part of Turkey. And all together, everybody will understand each other. And from this complicated issue, I believe nice flowers come out.
Tristan, did you manage to find anything else about the third airport and plans there too?
Yeah, one of the things that I think is really a hot topic there, because they've been awarding contracts and they just announced it very recently, is a third airport in Turkey, in Istanbul, which is huge because if you look at what they're planning to do, they want to build a hub for 150 million people. So that's double the size of some of the biggest airports in the world. So their eyes on growth. Their eyes on really outdoing almost anybody in the world, and it's clear they may because they're going to double their fleet, which right now is 217 by 2020.
Crazy. Good luck to them.
I know, 150 million people.
That is staggering, isn't it?
It's insane, well, absolutely insane.
Tristan McAllister, our transport editor, thank you very much indeed for them.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du var Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now, festival season is gearing up in the UK. It takes more than rain or even hail to keep music lovers away from the fields. This weekend, many have headed to the Isle of Wight to writhe around in the mud.
And Glastonbury's coming up in a couple of weeks too. But those less keen on getting down and dirty might want to head over to London's South Bank, where the annual musical mashup that is Meltdown is about to take place. Meltdown has a guest director each year who controls the playlist. Previous curators include David Bowie, Morrissey, Massive Attack, and my personal favourite, Patti Smith.
Well, this year, Yoko Ono is stepping up, and Jane Bees, organiser of the event and senior music programmer of Contemporary at the South Bank, joins us on the line now to talk about what's in store. Good morning, Jane. Thank you very much for joining us. So what is in store? We've obviously mentioned Yoko Ono there. What does she have for us this year?
Well, good morning, everybody. We've got 10 days. We start today, and there's a sort of really, as there always is, a varied lineup of not just straightforward musical events, but, this year we've organised two weekends which encompass talks, debates, workshops. You know, Yoko's obviously always had a very sort of political and activist career as well. You know, she's always been an activist artist, so this weekend we're talking about activism and art, and so we've got 2 days, Saturday and Sunday, during the day where we've got a sort of whole host of quite special guests coming on, actually. But, you know, there's also obviously the musical events. It starts tonight with Yoko's show in the Festival Hall.
Can you give us a hint at who those special guests might be?
Oh, I'm gonna keep tight-lipped about that, but I can guarantee it's going to be a really interesting weekend. We've got... So who's coming that I can tell you about? We've got the Gorilla Girls coming from America, who is a sort of feminist visual art group who've been working since the mid-80s. That's really exciting. We're launching an incredible book Saturday afternoon at about 4:30, I think, which is called Let's Start a Pussy Riot, which has been put together by a wonderful woman called Emily Noy, who basically, you know, reacted to the Pussy Riot situation in Russia and put together some special events over here to fundraise. And then she started to put together what she originally envisaged to be a fanzine, which has turned out into this kind of quite weighty tome now with lots of different contributions from different artists, including Yoko. So Rough Trade are publishing that, and we're going to launch that tomorrow.
And Jane, it's a very comprehensive lineup, as you say, not just of music, but a whole host of different events. How do you go about curating it each year? Do you start with a person and then it sort of leads into a discussion about what they would like to do, or do you sort of go to them with an agenda?
No, I mean, it's a very sort of open brief, really. And really, we just start choosing who we would like to invite to curate it and then sitting down and having a conversation with them about what it could look like, how broad it could be in terms of the genres of work that we can represent. You know, over the years we had a visual art exhibition on Bowie's Meltdown. We've done theatre pieces, dance pieces, literature events. You know, it usually comes from a sort of musical starting point, but obviously most artists have passions, you know, across all areas of work. So we like the festival to kind of really represent the personality and the working practices of the person that we choose. So, you know, obviously with Yoko, she had her fantastic visual art exhibition at the Serpentine last year. So we've focused really on the music side of her career, but there are a lot of art installations around the site. So if you come down and have a wander around, you'll be greeted by the Imagine Peace banner that we have on the back of the hall. And there are various installations across the site, including a piece by Gustav Metzger, who you know, is just one of the most important figures in British counterculture art and a very long associate of Yoko's. So you should really come down to the site and explore. And, of course, all those things are free, so explore and seek them out.
You mentioned the Serpentine there, and I know that Yoko Ono will be in conversation with their great legendary curator, Hans-Ulrich Obrist. In terms of how the whole festival runs, is it very much a mix of those sorts of events that are kind of, you know, there and planned, and then, as you say, people wandering around and just soaking it all up? For a first-time visitor to Meltdown, how should they sort of plan their visit?
Well, I think, you know, obviously start by looking at the programme. There are still, we've sold out a lot of our events, which is fantastic, but there are still a number of events that you can get tickets for. And even with the sold out events, you know, it's sometimes worth phoning up on the day because we sometimes release production holds at the last minute. But so start with the programme. But, you know, the South Bank is a 20-acre site. And so, you know, it's part of our philosophy to try and open up the whole site and have as much free program as possible. So, you know, for example, tonight, if you haven't got a ticket for Yoko's show, we have a band called Baltic Fleet from Liverpool who recently won an award in Liverpool, which is called the Git Awards, the Get Into This Awards. It's also known as the Scouse Mercury, obviously, and they'll be playing on the ballroom floor free before and after Yoko's show. So we like to mix it up that there are obviously some ticketed events, but there's obviously a lot of free stuff in there as well.
Wonderful. Well, Jane Bees, organiser of this year's Meltdown Festival, many thanks indeed for coming on the show. And time for some music before we head to the news. This from one of the previous curators of the Meltdown Festival. This is Fashion by David Bowie.
David Bowie with Fashion there. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll be heading to one of the world's fashion capitals for the news from Italy with our man there, Ivan Cavaglio. We'll also review the Finnish front pages with our resident Finn, and we'll enjoy a taster from this week's menu.
We asked to the client what level of a spicy one. We have three levels, low, medium and high. Some people ask, yeah, I have very spicy, not level 3, level 5, please. Okay, level 5.
Level 5 spicy for me too. But before all that, here's David Spencer with the news headlines.
Thank you very much indeed. Russia says US claims of chemical weapon use by President Assad's forces in Syria are fabricated. The findings have led President Barack Obama to authorize the sending of weapons to Syrian rebels for the first time. The polls have opened in the Iran presidential election. Six candidates are in the running to succeed Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who can't run for a third term in office. Turkish protesters have held talks with the Prime Minister in a bid to resolve a dispute that's led to 2 weeks of violence. Recep Tayyip Erdogan met a delegation overnight in Ankara, including members of the umbrella protest group Taksim Solidarity. Protests in Brazil against a rise in bus and underground fares have spread from Sao Paulo to other cities, including Rio de Janeiro. Marches have taken place calling for the increases to be revoked. The British government has issued an alert to airlines around the world, urging them not to allow former US intelligence contractor Edward Snowden to board flights to the UK. He's been in Hong Kong, where he revealed himself to be the whistleblower behind the leak about a controversial US spying program. The maiden flights due to take place of the newest aircraft from European plane maker Airbus later today. The A350 is a direct competitor of Boeing's Dreamliner and is designed to be more fuel efficient. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Let's hope the Airbus 350 gets off to a less turbulent start than the Dreamliner, shall we?
You can't get away from those puns, can you?
This week's preview of the menu comes from Singapore, a city of such legendary street food. There's now a whole 10-day festival devoted to it. This year's inaugural World Street Food Congress featured nearly 40 of the best street food hawkers from around the world, as well as some spirited discussion on the importance of preserving this dynamic culinary heritage in areas where it's under threat.
Our Singapore correspondent Justin Bergman tasted everything from Mexican tostadas to Malaysian siam and filed this report.
The first rule walking into any hawker centre in Singapore is to look for the stall with the longest line. So when I arrived at the World Street Food Congress and surveyed the 37 different street food masters from around the world, that's exactly what I did. The woman taking orders in the giant sombrero was also kind of hard to miss. Sabina Bandera and her daughter Mariana operate a street food cart called La Guerrerens in Ensenada, Mexico, which makes incredibly tasty seafood tostadas topped with homemade salsa. This is no simple street food cart, however. Sabina has been feted by none other than celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain, who said her tostadas were so phenomenal, he would drive 5 hours from Los Angeles just to eat one. Mariana describes the dish as she prepares one for me.
Tostadas, we put in a fried tortilla a base of mixed ceviche that is octopus, crab, and kingfish, cooked with lemon and vegetables. We ask to the client what level of spicy want. We have 3 levels, low, medium, and high. Some people ask, yeah, I have very spicy, not level 3. Level 5, please. Okay, level 5.
I opt for the level 3 spiciness, which elicits quite a celebration behind the counter.
Thank you.
This is just the opening salvo of a flavorful 5-course street food dinner that includes Malaysian, Vietnamese, Indian, and Danish dishes. Yes, the Danes have street food. Well, I should say they have street food as devised by Claus Meyer, co-founder of Noma Restaurant in Copenhagen. Meyer's stall was selling his signature pork sandwiches, topped with apples, Greek yogurt, and roasted pork skin, which had a line stretching across the fairgrounds. Meyer is a street food champion. He believes an event like this is necessary to promote the value of traditional street food, which he says is under threat in many parts of the world.
It's important to celebrate this culinary heritage, because in many of the poor countries there is a tendency for international fast food chains to outcompete the hawkers. First of all, because they are, you know, they're competent at what they're doing, they are appealing to the lowest taste, and young generation, they also want to be, when they get a little bit of money, they want to be a little bit like the Americans or like the Europeans. So there is, on the one hand, this McDonaldization threat. On the other hand, It's also the fact that many young people in the emerging economies, they don't want to work the same way that their parents have been working. They don't want to work, you know, these extremely long hours with very hard work in a very warm environment. So at a generally speaking, very low wage per hour.
This is exactly the point of the Street Food Congress, says organizer KF Sito. Sito has made a career of trawling the night markets and back alleys of Singapore, Bangkok, and other Southeast Asian cities for the very best street food stalls, which he compiles in his exhaustive Makan Sutra guidebooks.
Street food came about, especially in countries that has a rich street food tradition, because people were desperate and they had to get out there to make their ends meet. A lot of them brought their own family heirloom heritage recipes out to the streets to trade for money, just to make their ends meet. Once upon a time, it was seen with disdain, but over the years, that culture had gotten so popular, it's iconic now. But as we move on into tomorrow, where food industries will feed you with God knows what, you realize that this old street food culture is just dying. Through the efforts of this Congress, we provide opportunities, brand awareness for what they do. They are, in fact, little soldiers that protect culinary heritage.
Sito's idea was to bring several dozen food hawkers from around the world to Singapore for a festival celebrating their craft. He had only a few requirements.
We are looking for hawkers that are inspirational, have very good practices, and can lend more meaning to this whole movement. Yeah, they should be inspirational, in short.
Jennifer Tan is one of the hawkers who made the cut. She runs a food stall in the old Malaysian trading town of Malacca called Donald and Lily's, named after her parents who started the business. I visit her stall and she gives me a demonstration of frying Malacca-style mi siam, a spicy noodle dish made with love. It takes her 5 hours to fry the spices for the all-important chili paste. The effort is worth it. The dish is absolutely fantastic. Jennifer is trying to uphold a family tradition in Malacca, something that she says is difficult.
My father is actually the first hawker who sells mee siam in Malacca. So nowadays, you go around the tourist area and everything, you cannot find good mee siam anymore. You know, it's like a dying trade nowadays. Before he came, I registered myself in the franchise course and everything. I said, who's going to take over me after this? I cannot depend on my children. You know, looking at the children nowadays, you know, they are on iPads and everything. They are not very interested. And then I said, oh dear. And I made a vow to my parents. There's no money. It's all right. When you die, make sure you die famous.
While food hawkers may be disappearing on the streets of Southeast Asian cities and other parts of the world, they are multiplying in places like Portland, Oregon. This city has removed the barriers to opening street carts and allowed them to rent space in privately owned lots. There are now nearly 1,000 street food carts in Portland, including the People's Pig, which was asked to join the Congress in Singapore.
We're making porchetta sandwiches. It's a roast pork belly with some Italian seasonings. Just really simple salt, pepper, fennel pollen. We're doing it as a sandwich on ciabatta with just like roasted garlic, some pickled peppers. Simple, tasty.
I asked the owner of the cart, Cliff Allen, what's driving the new street food culture in Portland?
It's so expensive to open a restaurant. It's just money. Portland is kind of leading the way in loosening regulations and making it easier for everybody to open a business. People that complain about it, say restaurant owners, restaurant associations, they want to kind of put the genie back in the bottle. And that's not going to happen just because everybody enjoys it. The last mayor of Portland was saying how it's such a bonus to Portland. People come just for the food carts, just to see what everybody's doing with food.
If Portland can do it, is Copenhagen next? Klaus Meyer isn't so sure, though this certainly would make him happy.
So a lot of migrated people who have come from India or Pakistan or Morocco or North Africa in general or from South America, they are having the most lousy jobs in our society. They're cleaning dishes, they are cleaning hotels, they're being taxi drivers. I could imagine that instead of doing all that, they would just be you know, cooking up fantastic meals that you could buy for not much money in a simple setting. That would make my country a more beautiful country.
A beautiful country indeed. For Monaco and Singapore, I'm Justin Bergman.
That got me quite hungry, I have to confess. But for more delectable food and drink stories from around the globe, do tune into The Menu with Marcus Hippie tonight at 1900 hours London time.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a check-in with the news from our man in Milan.
This weekend, come and join us for Monaco's very own take on an old English tradition. The second annual Monaco Country Fair will feature a selection of our favourite nations, retailers and delicacies. Wales, Colombia and Sweden will all be showcasing their wares and will have clothing from Drake's, Henchman and Trunk. And of course the all-press cart will be serving piping hot coffee throughout the weekend. Plus we've got a petting zoo for the little ones. So come down to Midori House on Dorset Street, Marylebone, London this weekend for the second annual Monaco Country Fair. And that's fair with a Y, of course.
Welcome back to Midori House. The time is 8:42 here in London and 9:42 in Milan, which is where we head now for a look at the headlines with our correspondent there, Ivan Carvalho. Welcome to the show, Ivan.
Good morning, Hugo.
So, Beppe Grillo, let's start there, shall we?
Yeah, surprising result of his five-star movement in the national elections earlier this year has seen a bit of a negative turn recently, because in the local elections that happened, the second round over the past weekend, we saw a retreat of support for his five-star movement. Now some may say, you can look at it and say, well, these were local elections, so his national election campaign, which is all about kicking out the corrupt politicians and going for a new electoral law, that really had a lot of attraction for voters. Whereas on the local election front, he didn't really have that same message, because some say all politics is local, and in those local elections, maybe the candidates he fielded weren't, some were saying, up to the game to do it. And so we saw this really poor result. He didn't even get into the second round. A lot of his candidates didn't even make it through. This is over 500, local elections. And even in Sicily, where his party had did well in a regional election last year, he saw no gains there. So Beppe Grillo is also facing some defections in his party now, people who aren't happy with his leadership. So it's he's coming at right now a difficult time for him.
Coming under a lot of fire, in particular from members of his party. Senator Adel Gambaro, I know, is just one of them who's been blaming him and his very outspoken blog posts for that poor showing. Where does this leave him?
Yeah, those blog posts are quite incendiary, and they go after the parliament. And the thing is that he's not, in parliament himself, but he has over 100 parliamentarians in the Senate and the House, and they have to deal with the other members of parliament. So they need to tone down some of that language, and some of the people in his movement are saying, look, we have to change the tone. And we've already seen a few defections last week, and then there's this senator that you just mentioned who's going to go under the microscope next week. They may expel her, and there's a few others that there's talk of a few dozen. So Beppe Grillo is going to he's calling out to the people on the web, as he's done in the past, to say, look, we want to hear from you to see, am I doing the right thing? Some people in his movement are saying he needs to go on television. He's been against for many, many months any of his people going on TV, any of the candidates, any of the parliamentarians going on television, because he finds it to be, again, part of the system, and he's, anti-system and anti-status quo. But right now, with these recent election results, the Democratic Party has regained some of those voters. Now, the center-right, a lot of people are saying they abstained. A lot of voters didn't go to the polls. But if Grillo can't, track some of those other ones, that they've gone back to the PD party, the center-left. So he's going to have to do some readjusting.
Ivan, let's move on to a topic in the news which is quite close to my heart, which is a protest in Venice to ban cruise ships from going through the Grand Canal. Explain a little bit more about this to us.
Action from Carnival and all the biennales they have, and just, it has over 20 million tourists a year, and a couple million of those tourists arrive by cruise ship. And And right now there's a lot of worry over the fact that, as everybody knows, there was the Costa Concordia accident last year in Italy. There was a recent incident in Geneva where people were killed when a cargo ship rammed into the harbor pilot's building. And people are worried about, again, the cruise ships coming very close. They come to the opening of the Grand Canal where St. Mark's Square is. And there's a lot of fear about the damage these ships can do, also the pollution they produce, because over almost 700 ships a year go in to Venice, and there's the dredging and the ecosystem of the lagoon. Everyone from UNESCO to local politicians are worried about it. That has to be balanced, of course, with the economics, because as everybody knows, Venice has only 60,000 residents, but it thrives off tourism. And so this is a classic case, again, of how do you balance that out, this equation?
Because how do you balance it? Because it is, we're talking $200 million annually that those tourists who arrive on those 650 cruise ships per year spend. Can Venice do without a portion of that?
Yeah, that's a difficult thing. I mean, right now, there was just yesterday a talk with the national government over what to do, and they've decided at the moment to look at solutions, perhaps to not let the ships anchor near St. Mark's Square, because in recent days, there was even part of the building, there was some pieces falling off a bell tower, which is quite serious, and there's always been lack of funds to do upkeep and maintenance. They've always had to go to private sponsors. So how do you balance it out? The mayor is saying, in some cases, we don't see a lot of the funding for when the ships are docked at the mooring fees. The city doesn't see a lot of that. One solution could be a cruise terminal farther out, and then they could bring in the people by bus to Venice, or again some kind of water taxi or Vaporetto solution there. I think the key is going to be they're going to try to find an alternative location where these people can come, because I doubt they're going to fully ban cruise ships, because it's an essential part of the economy, even though there are a lot of these people are, of course, day trippers who are buying a drink or a panino at the most.
Ivan, just tell us very quickly now another iconic thing about Italy, really. Teaching English, though, in university courses, how does this square with the Italian pride in its own language?
Yeah, this is quite something interesting that surprised me the other day. The Politecnico in Milan University, very, very well-known university in Italy, the rector decided that it should go looking at, for the future, to teach only its courses, graduate, undergraduate, in English, because now with the global economy, they're trying to get their students ready for this new environment. And there was a bit of a backlash. There were some professors that said, no, we shouldn't go all exclusive to English, and they went to the court to hold up this decision. Now there's going to be probably some mediation to figure out what they're going to do. It's interesting because in Italy, the Italian university system hasn't quite been up to snuff in recent years. If you look at those international classifications, those international rankings, obviously they tend to be skewed towards the Anglo-Saxon world, but since a lot of students, are going to have to use English at some level, whether it's in the sciences or other fields, this rector at the university said, "Look, this is a decision that needs to be taken, because we need to be competitive, because very few foreign students come into Italy to study. You see a mass migration, people going abroad to do Erasmus and doing graduate degrees. I remember in California when I was at university, I saw tons of Italians coming in to study at the graduate level. And so this is a move to sort of try to make it more competitive and bring some students in and bring in, obviously, fees to these universities. So it's probably the beginning of a trend, because we've already seen some of the private universities like Bocconi University here in Milan, very well respected one, doing it. So that's going to be sort of possibly a cultural shift in the higher education system here.
Wonderful. Well, our man in Milan, Ivan Carvalho, many thanks for your time, as always. We'll be having a roundup of the Finnish front pages in just a moment. But first, this is one of my favourite songs from Finland. This is Jenni Vartiainen with En halu kula tänä yönä.
Finland's Jenni Vartiainen with En halu kula tana una, which apparently means I don't want to die tonight. It's time now for a roundup of this day's Finnish front pages, with many apologies for my Finnish pronunciation there. Markus Hiipi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me in. I'm so proud of your pronunciation. It's getting better day by day. I know Hugo likes that song. It's En halu kuolla tänä yönä.
Oh, we should have just got you to back announce it. What have you got for us in the newspapers?
I'm looking at the Nordic papers. I thought to start with OECD's new numbers regarding immigration. For the first time, OECD has actually been calculating what the price is for immigration for many countries. And it's quite interesting read for the Nordic nations that are also discussing immigration and whether it should be limited, because it's turned out that all the Nordic countries are actually making money practically through immigration. What OECD has been doing is that they have actually calculated the economic contribution of each immigrant household, how much they actually contribute to the local economy, compared to the price societies pay for immigration in terms of benefits and so on. And actually it seems that they're doing quite a lot of money, thousands of euros, in the Nordic countries.
How does it break down in the Nordic countries?
I don't have the precise numbers, but all the countries, Norway, Denmark, Finland, Sweden, are all making money. Not as much, though, as the ultimate winner of this comparison, that was Switzerland. In Switzerland, they're making as much as 15,000 euros per household. Another related story is actually from Sweden. There is a bit of aftermath of Stockholm riots. And I think this is a very Swedish approach to things, trying to learn something and having a big discussion after that. And there's a very fair discussion opening from the head of Sweden's employment agency, who has said in an interview yesterday that the situation is simply so that Swedish employers have to be more open-minded in their recruitment.
She said that they could be a labour asset. As you say, it's a very Swedish approach to rioters in the city.
Exactly. And she was even joking about the organisational skills of vandals during the riots. And a question she poses is that if you are a brain surgeon, do you really need to speak perfect Swedish? And it reminds me of my home country as well. Finland is not an easy place to come to if you are a foreigner. For many jobs over there, if you want to work as a civil servant or so, you actually have to speak both the official languages of Finland. So it's not enough that you learn Finnish, that was just recently ranked to be the fourth most difficult language in the world. You also need to know Swedish, which makes it practically impossible to get proper jobs in there. Often. I think we should move on to a third story that actually makes me really excited. I just realized actually today that this is the day many have been waiting for so long in Helsinki. We have six candidates for the design of Helsinki's new central library, and the winner is going to be announced in an hour or two today.
Well, we will definitely follow up with news of the winner later on in the day. But tell us what this represents for the city of Helsinki. Is it Turunlahti?
It's Turunlahti. What makes this extremely special is that Helsinki doesn't really have a central library at the moment in terms of the library being central. It's actually in Itä-Pasila, which is relatively far away from everyone. And in very central Helsinki, next to Turunlahti Bay, there's an empty area that's been under construction for who knows how long. And they're gradually building something there. And it's going to be a center for cultural institutes. So Finlandia House is there, where they have a lot of concerts and so on. There is Kiasma, Modern Art Museum, and now Central Library is going to be placed in the same place. And that's basically the place you see for the first thing when you get to Helsinki, Central Helsinki, when you get to the train station.
I just can't tell you how much I'm in love with this story. I'm just so encouraged and enthused by the fact that we're celebrating the building of a library rather than the destruction of a library, which is what we're seeing in so many other capital cities. And, you know, just looking at the rise of bookless libraries we've seen in the last few weeks, you know, that any bibliophile's blood will begin to boil with that oxymoron. But it is just, do you think that's indicative of the spirit of the nation in a way?
I think it is. Helsinki is in a constant move. Helsinki's development is going to a very much better direction. And Hugo, actually, you being our design editor, I would like to actually hear your opinion on the designs. I brought you pictures of those
you
six.
You did. You very generously printed out the six. I mean, the Finns love an architecture competition, and I'm guessing looking at all of these designs, that they are Finnish architects.
They all look really airy. They all look really... You know, you've got Finnish materials, a lot of wood in there. Mm. The colours are very Finnish.
A lot of wood. I like the fact that from the renderings, people have put winter in there because obviously it will be under snow for 6 months.
People building snowmen outside the library.
Important. What's nice about each of these... I'm not going to pick a winner just...
just yet.
Not on air, anyway.
Go on, predict one, design editor.
No.
Go on, put your money where your mouth is.
No, I will be coming on later in the day to say that, yes, I knew it would be that one.
I had this hunch on Midori House this morning.
Indeed.
I just hope the same thing doesn't happen that often happens in Finland, that they realise that there is not enough money and then they have to make the designs slightly more modest.
Well, Monocle's Marcus Hippie, many thanks for coming on and delivering us with that. So that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much to our producer, Aled John, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and James Bullock, and our studio manager, Chris Fitch. Up next after the news, I'll be back with the latest episode of Section D, so do stay tuned.
Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.